Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about, once again, for the first time in a while, Bradley Pitt.
First time in, 4 months?
Maybe. Well, we've done a Brad Pitt film, but he was in it for like 3 seconds.
Yes. We've covered pretty extensively the Brad Pitt cameos.
Yes.
We've been fairly faithful, but that has meant that we have drifted from Brad Pitt.
But we're really returning to Brad Pitt with a vengeance.
In a big way.
Yeah.
Because this is a long movie with a lot of Brad Pitt.
There's a quote that we mention sometimes where he talks about feeling uncomfortable being at the center of the frame. Something like that.
Precisely.
He's really at the center of the frame in this film.
So this film that we get to talk about today, Wolfgang Peterson's Troy, is the film that led to Brad Pitt becoming disillusioned with Hollywood. This is, I think, the major pivot point in his career.
For an actor who is considered to be the archetypal Hollywood star, one of the like 4 Hollywood films he's made.
And the most Hollywood,
yeah.
Right? Like even
in the classical sense.
Exactly. Even something like Ocean's 11, which is clearly riffing on Hollywood stereotypes, is not as much of a Hollywood blockbuster as Troy. We also, because we had time away and we were doing other things, we missed a fairly major piece of Brad Pitt-related news. He appeared in a table read for the film Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Which I just realized I told you I'd watched before this and haven't actually watched.
I've watched the bits with Brad Pitt.
Yeah, I've watched a couple of the bits with Brad Pitt.
And he is charming.
Yeah, a lot of...
Surprising.
Bangles, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I sent you the clip and I was like, Dan, I don't know how to tell you this, but I think Brad Pitt is charming.
Yes.
Because it's Jennifer Aniston is in there too, and so is a very stone Shia LaBeouf, who was like clearly better than everyone else. He cleaned the floor with them. And Pitt just looked... he looks like he's thriving. At the moment.
Definitely.
Which is
he's
weird.
Living his best life.
Yeah, because who else is living their best life in 2020?
Well, I guess no one's taking photographs of. Like, if you're Brad Pitt, it's not a lot of fun to be on the street in a big crowd of people.
That's true.
I guess.
It's probably more fun than ever.
Yeah.
Although, do you think paparazzi...
He doesn't have to make movies?
No, which we know he
likes. Doesn't like.
He would prefer not to for the most part. Yeah, he can just sit there and work out what's on the Plan B production slate. How he can lose some more money. Is it Plan B, his studio?
Yeah, which co-produced Troy.
Yeah.
Which just surprised me. I think it's the first time we've seen a Plan B, whatever you call those things that pop up before movies.
Yeah, title.
Title
screen,
yeah.
I guess so. He odd, right, because he's badmouthed this film for almost 20 years.
Yes. And also it doesn't seem like, he seems like an actor in this film. It's not got anything... It doesn't feel like a passion project of any kind.
The film it reminded me most of, which it is better than,
mm-hmm.
It reminded me a little bit of 7 Years in Tibet.
It is much better than 7 Years in Tibet.
But
it's an epic, Brad Pitt's not quite at home in it.
Yeah, old school with weird bad accents that mismatch across the picture. An attempt to do the film that you just rock up at the cinemas and you're like, what movie should we watch? Oh, 7 Years in Tibet is playing. Let's go and watch this.
Definitely.
Troy has the same vibe.
Troy might be one of the last of that era of the kind of Titanic Gladiator, which you have mentioned when we've been discussing this film.
So shall we do, before we dive into Troy, I think there's 2 contextual things.
Mm.
I think we briefly have to talk about sword and sandal epics.
Yes.
Which, anyway, we'll get into
it. I never really
Have you seen any?
I think...
Of this post-Gladiator wave, post-2000 wave?
I mean, unless you count Lord of the Rings.
Which you kind of do.
Yeah, I was a big Lord of the Rings head.
Well, so this is the weird... Oh no, Dan, my protection from viruses has expired.
Oh dear.
I have to close this pop-up. Oh, dear. You know, I haven't had a computer virus in, like, 20 years.
I feel like they stopped being a thing.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder why.
McAfee is trying to scare me.
He just got arrested today.
Did he?
Yeah, at an airport in Spain, I think.
Really?
That'll make this podcast. But, yeah, I believe so.
What's his name? John?
John McAfee. He's a maniac.
He's truly a maniac.
Yeah.
Have you seen the documentary about him?
No.
The things that he's into sexually?
Oh.
I cannot speak them
aloud.
Okay,
I didn't realize. Maybe,
I think they're turning that documentary into a film and like Zac
Efron
is in
it. I think I did hear that. Fun.
The world is bad often.
Baffling.
I think the history of the sword and sandal epics is there is an explosion of them in kind of classic Hollywood. Mm. You know, Spartacus, Ben-Hur, these are massive films that make a lot of money. And from that point on, just become a staple. Like, an award staple is you take an old story, usually a doomed romance, put some famous British people in it, and voila, you have a film that will clean up at the Academy Awards.
Riffed on in Hail Caesar, the Coen brothers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The big one that I think of, because it was always on TV when I was growing up in the UK, was Anthony and Cleopatra.
Oh, yeah.
With Richard Burton, who's, like, one of my favourite actors.
What about Lawrence of Arabia? I've never seen that.
I think that's slightly different, right? Because Lawrence of Arabia wasn't in the distant past when that film was being made. And Lawrence of Arabia is also like one of the 20 best films ever made.
Okay.
It's untouchable. Whereas most of those old sword and sandal epics, when you watch them these days, you're like,
I guess I'm just thinking of deserts.
Yes, I think you are. And also Peter O'Toole is the lead of Lawrence of Arabia, who's in Troy. So they kind of go away, I think, for a long time, these sword and sandal epics. They become very uncool. And then in 2000, you have Ridley Scott's Gladiator, which you haven't seen.
No,
right?
I should.
It's a really good movie. Weirdly, watching Troy, I was like, you know what? I want to go and see Gladiator. And I think not only the success of Gladiator, which like picks up at the Academy Awards in a really big way. That was the year Ridley Scott was nominated for Best Director and loses to one of two Steven Soderbergh nominations.
Not very funny.
And it's like this huge commercial success and kickstarts the genre anew. But I was thinking, I think an adjacent success story is, as you say, Lord of the Rings. So they're like, oh, bows and arrows are cool again. Yeah. And I think suddenly people are like, oh, we can make this work. And the interesting thing is, for the most part, people can't.
Hmm.
If you look at like post-2000 sword and sandal epics, most fail. Like, a lot of them are directed by Ridley Scott and are very bad. Like the Robin Hood, Russell Crowe movie.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
The Orlando Bloom, Ridley Scott movie Kingdom of Heaven, which is about the Crusades. Do you remember that one?
Vaguely.
Did very badly in almost every respect. And I was thinking, the genre isn't really saved again until Zack Snyder's 300.
Oh, yeah, which I have seen.
Do you like that movie?
No.
I think I like that movie.
It's silly, I think.
Silly and bad politics, like definitely a fascist film, but kind of overwhelming in terms of pure spectacle.
I like the spectacle. I think I would want to walk around. Here's the context in which I think speaks to my concern with intention, I guess, which is, I think I would be interested in that film if it was a series of still images at a grad school art exhibition. I'd be like, whoa, this is cool. Weird. What is that? Cool. Like, better than, you know, boring stuff.
Well,
I think as a film, I'm just like, well, you're too self-serious. I think the self-seriousness is something I find difficult to get past.
When you said it should be a series of still images, I'm like, well, then Dan, you would love the comic book 300, which it originated
as. Of course. Because I think it's the thing. It has a bunch of striking, like, people in it and a bunch of striking color palettes. Not necessarily good.
It's mostly Zack Snyder used the comic book of 300 as a kind of storyboard.
Yeah,
and
sure,
you can tell all the most interesting images are taken from Frank Miller's OG.
What would a Jared Butler cast look like?
I think it could be fun.
Really? Because I feel it would be interesting, but it would be interesting in a kind of descent into a particular...
He's slightly more varied than I think people think sometimes. Like, he's in a Guy Ritchie film. He's in Rock and Roll.
Oh, yeah.
Those White House Down movies or Olympus Has Fallen, whichever one he's in.
Something Else Has Fallen.
They're pretty good.
Okay. Sure.
You're selling me on the Jared Butler cast.
I could watch it.
Because it would be interesting, right? The joy of watching every Brad Pitt movie is you're watching the evolution of mainstream Hollywood cinema.
Yeah.
But it would also be interesting to pick someone like the Wallace Shawn cast, you know?
Oh, boy.
Where you're just watching films that are just insane. Yeah. Have nothing to do with one another. You get a Toy Story, then you get some weird New York theater project.
Definitely.
What was I saying? Something about 300.
300 is the resurrection of the sword and sandal.
And then it dies again.
Was anything made based on... Did 300 inspire anything?
There's a sequel. It's called like 300... Dan, you should be at Hollywood Big League 301. It's called like 301 The Rise of Sparta. Wasn't directed by Zack Snyder. Kind of has nothing to do with anyone from the original cast.
Okay.
I was briefly going to say, so Frank Miller, the comic book artist who wrote 300, do you know anything about him?
A little bit, yeah.
Do you know that he went he went a little loopy post 9/11 and wrote a Batman comic about Batman fighting Osama bin Laden.
I didn't know that. Is it problematic?
You know what, Dan? It is. He was always... His art is often explorations of fascism, right? And everyone was always like, what is going on with this guy? Which was interesting because he became famous at the same time as Alan Moore, famous British comic book writer, who is famously an anarchist, other side of the political spectrum.
I watched a trailer for Alan Moore's new film today.
Alan Moore's new film?
Yeah.
A film he made?
He wrote, and someone else directed. Apparently it's a sequel to a bunch of, like, telemovie stuff they've made. It's called... Not The Room, but something like that.
Why did you watch that?
It just turned up on a Twitter, I think.
He did write a film.
And I was like, weird, and it looks interesting.
That he kickstarted? He funded through Kickstarter?
This could be it.
I love Alan Moore. I love him so much.
The show.
It's very Alan Moore.
Watchmen writer stars in his first movie. He's in it. I thought he was. I needed to double check. I was like, that guy in a lot of makeup looks like Alan Moore. Turns out it was. Anyway, we can... Sorry.
No, it's interesting.
Alan Moore and...
So Frank Miller, post 9/11, I think was having addiction issues and there were other things going on. But he was like, you know, these Occupy Wall Street freaks, they don't understand makes America great and we should kill, you know, every terrorist. And the Batman comic is called Holy War on Terror Batman.
Oh dear.
And it's a rough time. But it's just interesting, right, that everyone was always like, is this guy a fascist?
Yeah.
And then he's apologized for the comments and mellowed out. And he wrote a Sword and Sandal TV series for Netflix this year that you won't have heard of because nobody watched it.
It's on Netflix?
Yeah, it's called, like, Cursed. It's a retelling of the Merlin story. It's like a YA adaptation of a comic book that he wrote for Netflix. Because you know Netflix make comic books now?
No.
Okay, they do.
Vertical integration.
The Kingsman guy, Mark Millar,
he
writes comic books for them with the idea that they'll sell the comic books and turn it into a TV series, so feed into both aspects of the business.
Love that.
It's good.
Content.
Yeah, media conglomerates, thumbs up.
Monopolies.
That's really it on Sword and Sandal Epics.
Okay.
It's worth noting that Troy was successful. I mean, like...
Moderately, yeah. Well, it made, like, $500 million, right?
On a $200 million budget.
Yeah.
So, pretty good.
Yeah.
Obviously not enough, as you say, to greenlight a sequel. Troy's.
Yeah, Troy 2.
Troy 2. Troy harder. Troy 2, hyper Troy. The only other bit of interesting background context that I think there is to give is the director of this film. Do you know Wolfgang Peterson?
No. I looked him up, though.
Have you seen any of his other films? Have you seen Neverending Story?
No, I haven't.
He was a German auteur who came to prominence in the new wave of German directors alongside people like Werner Herzog and Fassbinder. So he made one very short, very low budget kind of quasi-Godardian crime film.
Okay.
Then he makes Das Boot. You've never seen Das Boot?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
It's like a 5-hour long submarine film.
Oh, I hate submarine films. Claustrophobic.
It's really good.
Okay.
When I was like 14 and starting to get into movies, my dad, who is not a big culture guy in general, like he doesn't really like music, he doesn't like books, he doesn't like movies. When he saw that I was getting into films, he handed me like 3 of the movies that he loved. Is that my computer? No.
Oh, it's a car.
It's a car.
In the background.
Oh, my goodness. He told me, like, these are the 3 movies that you should watch.
Okay.
And they were Peter Greenaway's The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and Her Lover.
Incredible.
So, very disturbing film. I watched far too young.
Yeah.
Silence of the Lambs.
Jeez.
Pretty disturbing. Watched it far too long. And Das Boot.
Wow.
And Das Boot is, as I say, this very long submarine epic that ends in a way that I won't spoil because you should watch it. That's just...
Okay.
The biggest gut punch imaginable. It's maybe the bleakest ending in cinema, I really think, because of the length and because of what happens.
Wow.
And then Peterson makes that film,
mm-hmm.
and then he goes to Hollywood and makes Neverending Story.
So Das Boot is German?
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's this German, like, weirdo, acclaimed filmmaker, comes to America. First film he makes is The Neverending Story.
Weird.
And then he makes, like, a Clint Eastwood bodyguard thriller called In the Line of Fire.
Oh, yeah.
With, like, John Malkovich as the villain. And he makes Troy. And all of his films are pretty successful. He stops making movies for 10 years, and his last film is The Poseidon Adventure.
Okay.
Which is another... He became the guy who was like, you go to him when you want...
A big epic.
But a big epic that apes films from the 70s, basically. But he's still alive.
Hmm.
He's probably rich, right?
He must be. If you're directing films in that era.
And if you're making a film that costs $200 million, you're probably getting a couple of mil. Yeah. Right?
And surely you're getting money in all of between that to be like attached to scripts that don't generate into anything. And I'm sure he's doing fine.
But he made Poseidon Adventure, then went away and then came back with some tiny German film in a way that implies that he couldn't make another movie. But maybe he was too old and he was like, I can't go to some far-flung country and, you know, hang out on set. Maybe just
back on set, like, but not in a way that was taxing at home.
So your history with Troy, you've seen this film multiple times.
Well, this is the second screen viewing.
You didn't see it multiple times at the cinema?
No, I just saw it once at the cinema. I saw Lord of the Rings multiple times at the
cinema. You saw it with your mum?
Yes. I saw it with my mum, but I saw Lord of the Rings 9 times.
Really? Your mum saw it more than once?
I was like 11, I think, or 12, yeah. Yeah, she had a good time. It was like a weekend ritual for us. The important thing to know about that era is that films were on forever. So it was on for like 9-10 months.
Yeah.
Especially a successful...
Particularly that film.
Yeah, a successful film just kept being at the movies. But so I think in order to kind of relive that magic, we saw Troy, and we had a good time. I was surprised... rewatching it, because I haven't seen it since
2004.
16 years. Wow.
Yeah, we're old. Half a lifetime ago, pretty much.
But it's pretty violent, which makes sense.
It's gross violence.
But yeah, I'm surprised that... I guess we knew what we were in for. It's visceral.
It's clothed, I think, in enough artifice that it doesn't feel shocking. And there's gratuitous. Very little
extended cruelty... or torture. There's some kind of... It promises some things, but is reasonably circumspect about how it presents you with violence.
Brad Pitt does do that, like, stab That's in the neck, in the...
Upsetting,
It's pretty gross. It's pretty gross.
Especially in a cinema.
I had some friends in the last couple of years of high school who were... At the beginning of high school, I had a big group of friends. Mm-hmm. And then depression hit, and I alienated myself from all those people. And basically just hung out with two... boys who were... I don't know why I hung out with them. They were pretty mean to me.
Yeah, like,
it was one of those weird relationships where I was just seen as the lowest status member of that group and picked on. And they liked to go to the movies, but they liked to be naughty when the movies were on. So we went and saw Michael Clayton starring George Clooney, and they were so bored that one of them stood up and dropped his pants and just sat there in his underwear, which is a pretty funny bit. Like,
it's been Michael Clayton. Yeah.
Yeah, Michael Clayton is the film to do that too. And it was with them that I went and saw Troy. So, and I haven't seen the film, as you say, for like 16 years. So basically all I remembered about Troy is there's a bit where Brad Pitt is shouting Eric Bana's name over and over because one of my friends thought this was the single funniest thing he'd ever seen. That just, you cut away and you can see Eric Bana milling about. And in the distance, you can still hear Hector. It made me laugh.
Funny. It's like Tetsuo in Canada and Akira. Yes. Yelling each other's names a lot.
Exactly.
I think I have fond memories of seeing it. It's not... As a work of art, it's not, like, successful.
No.
But
I don't know if I like or dislike this.
Yeah, film. I have similar feelings. I think there are some truly awful performances and some really watchable performances.
Mm-hmm.
I think Eric Bana's pretty good.
I was going to talk to you about it.
I think he is...
Really?
At the beginning, I didn't love him, but as it moved on, he works as a Hector. I think it was a silly casting decision, but I think it should be kind of someone who is older and kind of rougher and...
He works as Hector because he's so fucking boring. And Hector is kind of just boring, noble guy.
I found myself being moved by a bunch of the scenes with Eric Bana in them. That's all. Moved? Like, yeah, genuinely.
Which scenes?
When he takes his wife, whose name I can't remember, down to the tunnels and is like, when the Greeks come, go down here and get out. I found that moving.
Really?
Yeah. And I was upset when he was fighting Achilles, when he killed Patroclus.
I think the best sequence in this film is when Brad Pitt as Achilles is like to Eric Bana, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, he's going to kill him. Yeah. And then Eric
Bana knows about, Hector is like, I'm going to die.
It's just an extraordinarily dynamic sequence.
Yeah.
And Brad Pitt plays it very well. Like, you've pissed me off, I'm going to kill you. Like, this is an annoyance more than anything. Yes.
I feel like I thought someone else was good. Oh, Sean Bean's amazing.
Sean Bean's always amazing.
Yeah, he makes I think he made me, and we'll get to this, I'm sure, but he made me watch Game of Thrones for four seasons when I should have only watched one.
Well, I mean, he dies in the
first one. No, I know, but I thought, I was like, well, I guess there's something in this show, and then there isn't after he goes. And there wasn't really in season one either, but...
No. He's just... I think Sean Bean is underrated as an actor who can portray grace. He just seems full of grace, always.
Yeah, gentle. You know what? Kind of a James Gandolfini vibe.
Yeah.
He's the UK's James Gandolfini because he seems like he could menace you, but there's always this streak of gentleness.
It's a kind of weird nobility, right? And that's why Boromir is so perfectly cast, because you get him to play against his natural strengths for most of the performance, and then at the end, when he's shot through with arrows, he can be like, I'm sorry, and he's instantly redeemed. Yeah. Don't you think? It's so fucking sad when Boromir dies.
A profound tragedy. I've seen it a lot.
Can you see it in your mind right now?
The slow music and the arrows.
Yeah. The shaky slow motion. Poor Boromir.
And is it someone yells, I think maybe Orlando Bloom, who's also in this film, yells, Boromir.
Yeah.
I see it into my memory.
I think the thing I found most distressing in Fellowship of the Ring is Gandalf dying. Yeah. I was pretty young, and I remember being like, it really sucks that Gandalf just died.
I mean, had you read the book?
No.
So I knew the film was coming out and read the book just before it came out. Amazing. So I knew he'd be back.
What sparked you to read the book? I just saw the trailer, and you were like,
I think I must have like, I do not know how I discovered it, but I remember being like, oh, there's a book coming, there's a movie coming out about Lord of the Rings. It was like being made at the time. It was during production.
Wow.
I don't know how I heard about it. And I was like, well, I have to read this book. Because I'd loved C.S. Lewis, loved the Narnia Septuagint or whatever, all those books.
Those books are weird.
I read them very little and C.S. Lewis was a bit of a nut. I guess I was just like this. Because the weird thing about me is if you look at some of my favourite authors, I should have been someone who ended up really into fantasy stuff. I just wasn't. Like, I haven't really read another fantasy book except Lord of the Rings and some Ursula K. Le Guin.
I was going to say, have you read Le Guin?
Yeah. I read a trilogy. The Dark Sea, is that something? I think I read that trilogy when I was like 12.
Left Hand of Darkness is another one too.
Yeah, okay.
Those are great books.
And I remember really liking it. My uncle gave it to me, actually. That was it. Which I don't regret. I love Lord of the Rings, and I then read The Silmarillion, which not understanding a word of it.
And no one reads this.
No, I read the whole thing when really? I mean, everyone's too young to understand it, but I was definitely too young to understand it.
Is that the one that's just basically a glossary?
It's just like, key terms. It's like a dictionary of lore.
I kind of love that
shit. And some songs.
I wish there was more of it. When are we going to get a property about which there is enough to say that someone will write an extended canon? Are we ever going to get, like, another Star Wars when there's just, like, 20 years of books, paperback books that top the New York bestseller list that nobody knows about?
Because people try, right?
Do they? Or do people just try and resuscitate the things that have already done that?
Well, if you think, like, The Hunger Games, Game of Thrones. Like, they're making, like, 10 different HBO series about that.
But where are the books? Like, where's that extended universe?
Well, I guess because George R. R. Martin's still working on the originals.
Yeah, no one can rush in quite yet. The Halo, I guess, the Halo series was the last big
video
one.
Games. That's interesting. The Fall of Reach.
Yeah, good book.
Really?
I read that one,
Oh, boy.
My partner, Brianna, is watching. I loved those games. My partner, Brianna, is watching from the beginning the X-Files.
Oh, yeah, which I've never seen.
Perfect artistic object. I love it so much. And so I'm always watching episodes. And it's also made me go back and buy off eBay $4 copies of the paperback spin-offs of the X-Files. And I remember when I was like 12, 13, I was just such a voracious reader. And the school library had so little that I just literally read everything that they had. And I remember they got the Halo books. And I was just like, I think those books are probably terrible.
Sure.
But I had the best time.
I mean, I had a whole shelf of Star Wars novels. Timothy Zahn novels. It was like a young Jedi like series about Luke's kids.
Yeah, Luke's kids. I had this Star Wars dictionary.
Yeah, or maybe Leia and Han's kids. Anyway, there were Jedi kids. Maybe Luke's kids as well.
I had this fucking dictionary which had all these characters, and I was so mystified by all these characters in the extended canon that I didn't know. So I just got little glimpses of their stories. It was very exciting.
Do kids do... Is that just that, like, now you have YouTube channels? Well, maybe that's the thing, right? It's like...
Sure.
You can watch a YouTube channel of someone unpacking your favourite Netflix series for 10 hours or just listen to the podcast that accompanies every... So we've devolved from, like, deepening to commentary.
I think that's probably right. I think that's very true. I mean, increasingly, a thing that I've noticed, which we've got to get on this brand money, Dan. Places are putting out content and putting out podcasts about the content themselves. Like, official podcasts.
I'm sure we could be an official podcast of something.
Of what? What is at the intersection of both of our interests enough?
I reckon we could do, like, I reckon if there was, like, a horror streaming service or something, you could make me watch horror films, and that would be interesting.
It was what we were thinking about doing instead of the podcast.
One of the ideas for this podcast is I would watch Horror Canon and then be traumatized each week.
I bet you we wouldn't still be doing that show.
We
wouldn't have had a hook. No one would have listened.
Yeah, I think that's true as well.
We would have just been another podcast. I don't think we'd have the same listening numbers.
I think you don't want a podcast that takes more than 7 words to explain the premise of.
Yeah.
And the podcast about Brad Pitt is pretty...
Does it for you.
That I'm also now thinking about my first encounter with The Iliad and the Odyssey, which was kind of my dad read me a children's book version of...
Both. With pictures?
With pictures, yeah. And I have strong memories. I was kind of disappointed these weren't really in this film. Of the different... The brass helmets and the bright feather the headdresses.
Yeah, the headdresses are great.
Really extraordinary. So that was... And then I've recently read The Iliad, like a couple of years ago.
Because you taught it.
I've taught it 2 or 3 times.
The Iliad is kind of good. I've read them both, and I think I prefer The Iliad.
Yeah, I actually haven't read The Odyssey.
Odyssey is just very streamlined, but the Iliad has the crazy shit, like the catalogue of ships, which I just love.
And the catalogue of violence, right? Yeah. There's a really wonderful... Alice Oswald has a book called Memorial, which, shout out to our friend Ned, put me onto, which is a book of poetry that just... like a kind of quote-unquote translation of the Iliad that just basically runs through characters and their deaths.
Wow.
And is beautiful.
Well, that led me to something that I wanted to briefly sidebar. I don't know how much there is to say. There is this trend, I think, at the moment of cool speculative fiction authors doing new translations of ancient texts.
Oh, sure.
So there's Beowulf.
Yeah.
Have you read that?
No.
It just came out.
I've read the old Beowulf, but...
The new Beowulf is great. Oh. It's really funny. It zips along. It's great. It's a new translation. I can't remember the author's name, but it came out a couple of weeks ago, and it's unbelievable. I was so excited because I love Beowulf so much.
Beowulf's fun.
Beowulf's cool as hell. It's
like first story, right?
Yeah, it's full of...
First written story.
Like, witches and shit, and people getting eaten up. It's great.
Yeah, good monsters. Grendel's mother.
All-time great monster. Yeah. There's that movie adaptation directed by Robert Zemeckis who keeps coming up at the moment. That's
right. Was that 3D? Beowulf in 3D?
Yeah. Starring fucking Crispin Glover as Grendel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Angelina Jolie.
I was just going to say. Yeah, Jolie. I remember posters, billboards for that.
And there was recently, right, the first translation of the Iliad by a woman.
Because I've read... there was a woman who wrote a kind of novelization of the Iliad. British. She writes a lot about war. Mm. I've read some of her novels. Pat Barker.
Oh, yeah, sure. People like she's good. Pat Barker.
But she wrote a version of the Iliad. A novelistic retelling, so not a translation. But there was also the... Yeah.
Yeah, it came out last year... Yeah, the first woman to translate the Odyssey, not the Iliad. Okay. Her name is Emily Wilson. Did you know about this? It came out in 2017.
Yeah,
People love it.
I did. Yeah, I haven't read it, though.
But yeah, the Iliad and the Odyssey are just great texts, I think, because they were oral texts for such a long time. So people just kept adding stories to them that they would, like, lengthen. And the... Do you know much? I did so much ancient history study across the course of high school and university. I did a bunch of ancient history undergrad study. So I have all these useless facts.
I have bits and pieces, but not
so not much. A big thing that the ancient Greeks used to do was that you would show off with the amount of stuff that you had memorized.
Yeah.
So the stories were not just impressive because of what happened to them. They're impressive in this very ancient Greek utilitarian way of like, I'm the best at telling stories because I know the most stuff. So that's why these stories have massive casts.
That's funny.
Are very long-winded, you know, take ages. Because, like, not much happens in the Iliad.
And it happens very... Like, it's a very short segment of this long war as well.
Yeah, exactly. There's also... Do you know about all of the attempts to... find the ruins of Troy.
Yeah, vaguely. I feel like I got obsessed with reading about those a few years ago, but...
Pre-First World War, there was this explosion in rich European dudes...
I love that stuff.
...who were like, I'm finding Troy.
Very funny.
I'm using the books, and I'm going to try and find the location. And I did this awful, awful undergraduate course, which was all about the attempts to find Troy... That was just the most stupefyingly boring
That's
thing.
That's very funny.
Because it was like, location 6 or location 3, who knows?
Because also, what can you take away from a course like that? Yeah. Like, there's absolutely no...
Oh, I think it was meant to be basically like archaeology basics.
Sure, but
they did this and they did... But fucking hell.
Very funny.
The stuff that I found interesting was that they were making significant progress in just archaeological digs, not in finding Troy. Mm. And then the war broke out. Okay. So there was it was just this really interesting time period where you had all these European people hanging out and working together, and then they're like, oh, the war's starting, better go home and suit up and get ready to kill you.
Yeah.
Probably a more interesting film than Troy. Not that Troy is bad.
Yeah, I'd say so.
This isn't a bad film. I want to really stress that. Do you think it's a bad film?
No, it's not a bad film. I don't know if I would recommend it to anyone...
In this
day
and age.
Necessarily. Yeah, it's just such a... It's so of its time.
If you hadn't seen it by now, I would be like, don't bother.
Yeah, I think that's it, right?
But if you had seen it, I'd be like, yeah, it's Troy.
Yeah, right? It's Troy. It makes a go of it. I can't... I mean, there's some... What happens in Troy? We haven't really talked about it.
Could you do the four-sentence game for Troy?
Well, maybe.
I think you could.
I just want to say one interesting thing about the Iliad as a work of fiction or literature or history or whatever... is it doesn't really have good guys and bad guys.
No.
And I think Troy does a pretty good job of not falling into that trap of resorting to antagonist and protagonist. I mean, we don't like Agamemnon.
No. We really don't like Agamemnon.
Yeah. That's true. Yes.
He's just the baddie.
Yeah, that's true.
And in fact, Achilles has to say, like, I don't work for that guy. That's how much of a baddie he's drawn as.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you're right. Yeah. There's no picking of the sides in Hector versus Achilles, for instance.
Yeah, definitely. Which is admirable.
You like them both and you kind of understand why they're both doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Can you four-sentence game?
I've got to remember all their names.
I don't think you do. Just use the actors' names. Because I couldn't. And no one will remember.
Which is so... Of course. But... Oh, Paris.
True.
Orlando Bloom. Paris steals...
Helen.
Launch a thousand ships. That's right, Helen. From... Agamemnon. Steals. I don't want to use that kind of language. That's...
The film trades
yeah,
in that
the
language.
Film, the prim- yeah, for sure. But, I mean, so does the original text, right?
I'm saying it. I'm cancelling the Iliad.
Homer.
On account of Homer. Yeah, on account of being misogynist.
there's some sensitive drawings of women in Homer, but yeah.
Dan, this is just like cancel culture debate. One more cancel culture debate.
Paris having an affair with Helen and takes her back to Troy... He, Paris, is Prince of Troy. That was parentheses.
I love it when you use parentheses because you're just cheating.
No, that was like, it wasn't essential to the narrative. You could slice it out and it would be okay. Agamemnon, in order to...
You have to say who plays
take
these people.
Revenge. Oh, Brian Cox. Because it's not Agamemnon, it's someone else who Helen is married to.
Oh yeah, okay. Played by Brendan Gleeson.
Brendan Gleeson, that's right. Brendan Gleeson, Trump.
Yes.
I couldn't get even up the Trump.
I don't think I would be able to watch the Comey role.
I was just interested, but and I knew it would be bad, but boy, not even fun bad, just
is
bad.
It looks terrible.
Yeah. Jeff Daniels just playing his newsroom character as Comey. It's insane. Agamemnon goes to Troy to take revenge against the taking of Helen from the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be the first sentence. Second
that
sentence.
That was
is,
a long
No, but
sentence.
Just that. Just Agamemnon goes to Troy to take revenge.
Okay.
After,
you're rewriting.
I feel, yeah, I am. But it's kind of tricky because there's a bunch of like things you could include.
There's
like,
ancillary stuff. There's lots of like, oh, yeah, background players. But go on.
Achilles reluctantly joins Agamemnon in the war against Troy. I don't know if I can do it. Because I'm getting so tangled in the details in order to describe any motivations.
Do you want me to try?
Yeah. I bet you can do it. Because you get less tangled in details than I do, though.
Orlando Bloom, Paris, falls in love with Helen from Troy and gets her to
run from Troy. The famous Helen from Troy.
And
sorry.
Shut up. Helen from Troy and gets her to run away with him. This causes a massive dispute that devolves into a war between Troy and whatchamacallums?
The Greeks.
During the course of this war, Achilles, famed warrior, kills Hector, son of King Priam, played by Peter O'Toole, the king of Troy. They smuggle a big wooden horse that's reasonably famous and sack Troy. And Sean Bean's like, it's pretty sad what you've seen here today.
Odysseus, I mean, that's the thing about this movie, though, right? It's almost a lot of mini-movies.
Yeah.
And, oh, something that we need to discuss as well. So the reason Achilles kills Hector is because Patroclus, Achilles' cousin, is super eager to fight. He's young and...
Who plays Patroclus?
I don't know. Some model.
I think so. Yeah. Not a person. I'm going to look.
And Patroclus dresses up as Achilles so he can go into battle, even though Achilles is told him not to fight. With Achilles not there, Hector thinks he's fighting Achilles, but kills Patroclus.
Yeah.
Garrett
Hedlund. He's from fucking Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh. Is he one of the people singing Please Mr. Spaceman or whatever?
He's Johnny Five. Who is that character? I don't know.
But in the book, or whatever, the oration, the original, there's some pretty intense homoerotic tension between Achilles and Patroclus that is completely obliterated in the film.
I think when we were talking
about... And then why does he do it? Like, it doesn't... The movie makes much less sense because it's like, well... The reason Achilles is so upset that Patroclus is dead because he loves Patroclus. And the movie, the Iliad hinges on that.
Yeah.
And the movie is just like, well, no homo.
In a way that hurts it, I think, across multiple spectrums. Because when you were talking about the beautiful helmets, I think the reason they cut them is gay. I genuinely think so. I think this film's biggest failing is that it is... I mean, you say that 300 is self-serious, but I think 300, accidentally or not, is extremely queer.
Yeah.
Like, 300 is so misogynistic that it comes around and kind of becomes, like, a homoerotic fantasy.
Yeah, like S&M kind of.
Yeah. I think that's one of the most unbelievable things about that film. Whereas Troy just wants to play it... Troy wants to be like, listen... These are strong, noble men who loved their women. Yeah. Everyone here got a woman that they love. In fact, so much so, they're willing to fight about it.
Yeah.
And it hurts the film.
Definitely.
That was 100% some studio head's note. When he was like, listen, I'm going to greenlight this movie, but there is to be no whatsoever. Not even a lingering look in this film.
Yeah, there's no. I mean, even the heterosexual sexual stuff is not particularly erotic.
It's kind of... I wanted to talk about this, right? It's something that I think we have to mention. This film was written, sole credited screenwriter, by David Benioff, who is the creator of Game of Thrones. And it's fascinating to me that he made this film and then many, many years later made Game of Thrones. But there was just stuff he obviously didn't iron out of his artistic practice.
Definitely.
Like, if you look at the structure of this film, it's basically a lot of backroom talking interspersed with one-on-one fights.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Game of Thrones. It's so Game of Thrones.
As more time goes by, the more I hate that series.
I think it's bad.
Yeah, I really find it... There's some good stuff in it, but as a general project,
I actually quite liked the first season. I was like, it's nice world building stuff. I'm interested. All these people are good actors.
Such potential.
And then it just, I thought, went completely off the rails. I want to find the other Benioff credits, because he was one of those guys who stuck around Hollywood for a long time.
He must have been young when he wrote Troy.
I think so. Yeah. I knew he was the one with the weird writing career. So he wrote X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Sure.
He wrote Gemini Man, which was the Will Smith
that
movie
Ang Lee
that was in production for like 30 years. So I think he was just brought on at one point.
Okay.
I don't think he was the most recent writer. He wrote the Spike Lee film 25th Hour. Have you seen that film?
No.
Now you're a Lee devotee, you should watch that film. It's an Edward Norton starring film about a guy who is going to jail in 24 hours. And so it's his last 24 hours.
Yeah.
But it's also about New York and gentrification and post 9/11. Okay. Great film. He wrote Brothers. Do you remember that? Jake Gyllenhaal, fucking Tobey Maguire, I think.
Oh.
Remake of like a Danish film. And he wrote an extremely trippy 2005 psychological thriller called Stay, directed by the guy who would go on to make Christopher Robin for Disney.
So, which people said was really sad, right?
Yeah, like surprisingly it's sad deeply for a child's sad. Film. It's about post-war malaise. Okay. Like, it's an insane film. So Benioff has this really weird career, but I bring him up now only to say this film has some ugly misogyny.
Yes.
And it's...
both in how it's shot and in how it's structured and scripted.
There is a scene where Brad Pitt is embarking upon a relationship with a quote-unquote slave girl played by Rose Byrne.
Yeah.
And in the sex scene, he's like... in this way that the film doesn't draw attention to, he's like grabbing her. It's a really unpleasant kind of vile scene.
Yes.
And
reminiscent of a bunch of stuff that happens in Game of Thrones.
Precisely. So, you know...
it's not a coincidence. Like, it's not... they're not stumbling into it, right? This is how they understand the world.
And also...
Benioff, at least.
The Iliad, as we say, deeply cancelable text. But you didn't need to make a film that perpetuated the misogyny of the Iliad.
No.
You just didn't. Like, there's all kinds of different things. In fact, I'm surprised that we haven't had one comic book or novel which is, like, the story of the Iliad told from the perspective of Helen.
Yeah.
It would be really easy to do that. You portray all the men as idiots. She's the only smart one. They could have done some kind of
vibe. I think Pat Barker's novel is kind of really? From the point of view of the women, but interesting. I'm not 100% sure.
Interesting. That makes sense. You could really get a meeting at any Hollywood studio by being like, retell this story from the perspective of...
yeah. Like, the fucking Nurse Ratched. Did you read the storyline behind that? The writer was like, he was in film school. I think this is right. I read like half an article about it because I was so mad. He was like, I want the new Netflix series, Nurse Ratched. He was like, what kind of content can I make that would be like super pitchable? Like, what story haven't we heard from? He literally did that. And it worked. Now he's got a Netflix series that no one will watch, but he'll have...
no one will watch.
However much money.
I have to briefly tell this story. Maybe I'll cut out the names of relevant people.
Sure, beep them.
I do have what I think is quite a pitchable idea for a horror remake of The Truman Show. Not a remake. Like, we've talked about it on this podcast.
That's right, you've told me about this.
And I managed to finagle myself into contact with the head of original programming. And I worked for a long time on this pitch.
Sure.
It's just a one-page pitch, and I was thinking, like... well, exactly, I think you do have to think, oh, you know, it's... I think I said, like, it's Truman Show meets Heathers meets Stranger Things was my pitch. And I thought, like, surely that will catch someone's eye. And I G'd myself up. I had this contact. I was like, all right, I'm going to do this. And I sent the email. And it was, like, 3 a.m. I've got so much I was doing other things. And I just sent it, and I was like, time to go to bed. And I woke up to what I assume was an auto-generated email, which is like the meanest auto-generated email I've ever read.
Uh-huh.
It was like, you have sent an unsolicited pitch. Nobody read this. It was instantly destroyed. It was saved and sent nowhere. Never contact us through this route again. So, word of warning if you're looking to pitch a streaming giant. They have to say all that stuff about no one read it in case you try and sue them for stealing their idea. It was just... I'm used to, like, pretty mean rejection letters in a literary world, which are just auto-generated, make no reference to you.
Yeah.
But this was fuck you for even daring. So what am I going to do? I feel like I have an idea. What am
Quibi.
I
going
to do? I guess I have to go to Quibi. Because I have no choice. But to go to Jeffrey Katzenberg and be like...
Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Who produced Sinbad.
Sinbad, yeah.
Which we talked about last week for you. Yeah. But in the future for us.
We're doing some trick.
We're doing it out of order.
Mm. I think Troy would have... speaking of digital tricks, I think Troy would have been better if it had no CGI. If it had been all, like, all less,
pretty
like,
shitty.
Not, like, gone more of the Lord of the Rings route. Like, obviously the Lord of the Rings has CGI.
There's not a lot of CGI, to be fair, to Troy.
Yeah, but there's, like, the...
the boats.
The boats. The also, in the battles, there's some fire stuff that is very obviously fake and just unnecessary. Maybe it's not. I don't know. You just want the visceral.
I think you get it a bit.
You definitely do in parts. The Achilles Hector battle is good.
Because I think Wolfgang Peterson is ripping off from what Ridley Scott did with Gladiator.
Yeah.
Which is, like, mostly realistic with mostly practical effects with some CGI. The other person I wanted to say that Wolfgang Petersen is ripping off, I made notes but then didn't bring my notes, but I can just see in my terrible handwriting. There's a scene in this film that is a beach invasion. What is it ripping off?
Oh, Saving Private Ryan? Yeah.
I genuinely think it is.
Funny. Which was what, like 2 years before?
No, quite a number of years before. Okay. Saving Private Ryan is 1998, so 6 years before.
All right.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
I just sat there and I was like, this is Saving Private Ryan. That's very funny. I guess Saving Private Ryan is just one of those films like that ruins a certain thing for a while. Because an audience is only going to think, oh, that Steven Spielberg did that the best way you could possibly do that.
I think Nolan's Normandy gets around that effectively.
Dunkirk, you mean?
Dunkirk, sorry.
Sure, because that film kind of doesn't try and do anything.
Yeah, but that's like almost the problem, right? It's like, well, you have to do something completely different.
Yeah. I actually think, and this is weird for someone who watches horror movies nonstop, I actually find Saving Private Ryan too viscerally upsetting.
I've only seen the opening.
I find it really upsetting.
Yeah.
Just too much.
I remember when I was little, Saving Private Ryan loomed large in my psyche because I was like middle primary school and a bunch of my friends saw it. And one, this is maybe an odd thing to talk about, but a friend in particular who was a refugee from Serbia, and he loved it. He was obsessed with it. And he had, like, seen violence in real life. And I always remember that very, like, he had been witness to a bunch of really horrifying things. And I always remember that really sticking with me. Like, why would you want...
Did he ever mention the stuff that he had seen?
Yeah, not super explicitly. Sometimes he mentioned kind of people threatening his family and stuff like that, kind of obliquely, and talked about, like, vaguely... some things.
I wonder if you've seen a real world violence, you want to see it realistically depicted, and anything else seems insulting.
But that always, yeah, perhaps. But that always, it was always unsettling to me that I had, that was, because I was, as I'm sure I've talked about in this podcast, it took me a long time to start watching violent films.
So you didn't want to touch Saving Private
Ryan? I was terrified of it.
Yeah. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
My dad, I remember, must have been around this kind of time, watched Black Hawk Down.
That was another film that loomed in that kind of, like, seemed...
My dad was always like, this film, you can never watch this film. Yeah. It's far too violent.
Which, I haven't seen it.
It's not that violent.
Yeah, funny. I feel like that was... There were certain films that made their reputation from a certain kind of viscerality in that era, like the late 90s, especially.
My poor dad. I'm sorry, it just makes me think of it. Sometimes I think about my poor dad that, you know, from the age of, like, 15 to 18, I'm still obsessed with movies, but that was just a time where all I would do is cycle down to my local library, just get everything I could get and watch it. No screening procedures really at all.
What are you... So, like, this is something I'm so interested in because watching... Sorry, I...
No, you go.
Because I think for me, especially this podcast has been interesting for me because it has... And even our friendship, I'm, like, watching movies I wouldn't have otherwise watched. I'm thinking more about... what it means to just sit down and watch a film from beginning to end. And I did that a bit of that. Like, I had my local Blockbuster, I would just watch stuff. But I think, for whatever reason, my personality is very much... I mean, if I got stuff from Blockbuster, I would watch it. Like, I wasn't quitting stuff halfway through. But what if... Didn't you get bored? Like, because a lot of films aren't good.
I had to really teach myself, I think, a valuable lesson in patience. I had this old DVD player that had the time code... like on the DVD screen so I could always see how long the film had been, and I would tape it up with tape so I didn't know how long the film had been going on for, because otherwise I'd be checking how long. And I watched stupendously boring films back then.
Yeah, I bet.
That I could never watch
now. Yeah.
I could simply never watch. I watched like 5 hour weirdo, you know, European art films that are my kryptonite. I just had... 2004 was the year, right? Because that was the year Birth came out. That's weirdly the year Troy came out. I was just a 14-year-old who just discovered the thing that he loved the most in the world. I was like, it's movies.
Yeah.
And I, as I say, I'm constantly still filled with the joy for movies. But I just had this period where I was just like, it's all I did. I think I've told you this. I would like print out director profiles from IMDb and put them in a big book and read them on the bus. Like, all I was doing was learning about movies and watching movies. It's nice. I have fond memories. There are these, as I say, these 2004 films that I just have this memory of being like, yeah, that was a boy who mostly felt kind of sad and confused, who was like, movies.
How much of your current movie watching has to do with trying to recapture elements of Discovery that you had in that era? Because I'm sure it's not all of it by any stretch, but is there anything of that?
Maybe, possibly. I was thinking... So the other day I showed my partner Brianna Alien. And Alien, when I saw it, I told you that I kept this list of, like...
Yeah.
My 200 favorite movies.
Yeah.
Alien was in second place for a very long time. And I do remember watching Alien and this sense of discovery was overwhelming. Like, oh my God, like, this is my art form. This makes me feel like nothing else. And I rewatched Alien with Brianna, who did not know about, say, the chestburster scene, didn't know about all this, like, iconic stuff. And through Brianna's experience, I did have that sense of rediscovery, which made me realize how rare that feeling is. It really made me go like, oh yeah, Alien is one of the best films ever made. Because I was like, I don't get this visceral rush all the time, or even very often. So you're always chasing those highs, right?
Yeah.
But they're just fewer and further between because you've gotten through so many of the iconic films. But weirdly not, right? Like, I don't know why it's coming up so much. Fucking Robert Zemeckis. But I rewatched Who's Afraid of... Who Framed Roger Rabbit the other day. Not Who's Afraid of Roger Rabbit. That's a great mashup.
That was an incredible crossover.
Which I had seen as a kid and hated. And I watched it the other day and I was like, oh, this is a masterpiece.
Okay.
Unbelievable masterpiece. So I did a total 180 on that film, which I hadn't liked.
That's a form of discovery.
And it was even a more intoxicating form of discovery. Because I've been my whole life going like, I don't like Who's Afraid of... fucking Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And then I learned that I did. The only thing I was very going to quickly say about my poor dad is didn't like movies, I would go to the library and just get any DVD I could find and then watch it. And usually ask him to watch it with me. So my dad would watch one or two films a week. I kind of want to talk to him about this because we've never talked about it. And I mean, because I was just getting whatever from the library, like, we watched some heinous shit together. Yeah. I don't mean, like, bad. I mean, like, morally deeply upsetting.
It was just available at the library.
Yeah, because my parents were not funny about any restrictions. But I remember my dad, we'd be watching these films. He's like, Joe, what is this? We watched The War Zone. Do you know that film?
No.
Directed by Tim Roth. It's an incest drama. It's a dad who, like, abuses his daughter. And, spoiler alert, she eventually stabs him in the throat with a knife. And I was 14 and we just sat there and we watched it together. And my dad, credit to him, afterwards... In a what I can see now was like very deliberate but completely naturalized way, just calmly explained to me, not in a way that made me feel condescending to. He was just like, you know, ugly things happen in the world, blah blah blah, life doesn't have to. So he like deflated it, but he didn't stop the film. He didn't say I don't watch this, which I can imagine other parents would.
What about the experience of watching a film with a parent where uncomfortable things, either extreme violence or sex or whatever, is happening on screen and you just feel... You didn't experience the, like, embarrassment or...
Which is insane.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I had no sense of cringe at that. And I do now these days.
Sure.
I would hate to go and see a film with my parents in which there was some kind of sex scene.
Yeah.
But yeah, my poor dad just sat there and watched... I mean, it extended... I made him watch Martyrs. Do you know that, the French film?
Vaguely.
So much violence. I remember my poor dad just sitting there like wincing. He was not good with violence. And he did it for me.
Huh.
Dads. You know? Did you watch movies with your dad?
Sometimes. We watched a few that were very important. Like Mad World. Mad World. We watched together a lot.
Would he say, Dan, let's put on a movie?
Sometimes he would be like, you should watch this. And then I would kind of initiate the watching often. Often it would be like something he'd recommended, then I'd be like The Graduate through him, relatively young. Yeah, a lot of kind of some like 60s, 70s stuff. Glengarry Glen Ross.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a good movie.
He would find a DVD for $5 at a secondhand bookstore or something and be like, oh, this is a great film, we should watch this. In fact, I told you he saw Husbands, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's on the podcast. And he remembered the final scene.
Yeah.
Like, that was seared into his memory. He saw it when he was, like, living in Germany at some theatre.
It's interesting. Did you feel the pressure of liking it because he liked them?
Probably. Although he was always... I mean, there wasn't much... I think... I didn't even really think about it that way. It was almost, like, if he liked it, it was good. to some extent, which was often true. I mean, we have very similar sensibilities, and that probably goes some way to explaining it. And some, like, comedies he's loved, that he loved as a boy, he would show me. Get Smart, we watched a lot of Get Smart.
Really?
That's yeah. So funny. So that was important.
To put a bow on the dad corner of the Brad Pitt cast. I do remember, because I was really troubled by it. It was during this time I said, because I was discovering the films of Quentin Tarantino at this time and watching all of these directors discovering for the first time and watching their whole filmography. And I would always, it's all I wanted to talk about. So I'd always be talking about it around the dinner table. And I remember my dad would be like, oh, I've seen Pulp Fiction, I really liked it. Oh, I've seen Reservoir Dogs, I really liked it. And I remember it was around when Kill Bill Volume 2 was coming out. And so all I was saying to my dad was like, there's a new Quentin Tarantino coming out. And he'd be like, uh-huh. And I can so clearly remember, we were standing, he was doing the washing up. It was in the morning before I was going to go to school. I was in my awful grey and blue school uniform. And I remember us talking about Kill Bill Volume 2 again. And my dad was like, okay. And I said to him, like, Dad, you love Quentin Tarantino. You've seen most Quentin Tarantino movies. Why don't you know there's a new Quentin Tarantino movie? Why aren't you thinking about when you're going to go and see it?
Mm.
And he said, I'd love to, but I don't have the time. And I remember being pierced in the heart with a terrible fear of growing old, which still to this day, I'm turning 30 in a couple of months, and always in the back of my mind, there's a slight worry, like, what happens when you hit an age and you don't care about movies anymore?
Yeah.
And I think the answer that I tell myself is, I'm just not that person.
No, I think that's important. I remember asking Mum, what would happen if I got too old to watch Play... If I wanted to keep watching Play School and Sesame Street. Like, would people make fun of me? Because obviously adults don't do that. I remember that.
And what did she say?
I can't remember the exact answer, but it must have been... I think it was something like, it's not something you have to worry about. Like, that can happen. You, like, you do what you want to do, basically.
Yeah, I think I have settled into being like, I'm just not my dad.
Yeah, important.
He didn't care that much about movies before he became a parent.
Joseph's not going to stop watching movies.
And if Joseph does stop watching movies, then that person's not really Joseph anymore.
Yeah.
So that's kind of fine.
Definitely. You're not going to stop watching movies.
No. This me, the important me, the future me can fuck right off. Is there anything else major we have to say about
Troy? We should talk more about Brad Pitt.
We definitely should. Well, we should say in relation to Brad Pitt's part in this film that for some reason, Troy cuts out the gods.
Yeah, fascinating, which are very important in the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Why do you think they do that?
Because
Gladiator has spiritual, supernatural stuff. It doesn't have gods, but it has, like, heaven.
Yes. Okay, that's interesting. I think it's to do with wanting to make it... Which is interesting because Lord of the Rings has come out, right? And that has a lot of... So the supernatural stuff does play. I think it must be, again, a notes decision about this is the kind of movie we want to make. We don't want it to be... I mean, the gods are pretty silly.
How would you do it, maybe?
Exactly. Like Apollo... Because what doesn't...
There's a lot of talk of Apollo. Yeah,
Paris doesn't... In the movie, Paris crawls back from... towards Hector after he has been beaten in a duel.
Mm.
And I think Apollo comes and rescues him and drags him back.
Mm-hmm. I think that's correct.
The book.
It's never really... They never really run into problems with it. Except, I think, in the biggest way, with Achilles' death.
Yeah.
Because famously, Achilles is immortal except for the part of him that was held when he was dipped into the River Styx, which is his heel. And so he gets shot in the heel and then he dies.
Yeah.
And in this, he gets shot in the heel and then he gets repeatedly shot everywhere else. It's very funny. Yeah. They couldn't stick the landing of, like, no, just in the heel.
Near immortality. Achilles is described as the son of a god, a demigod. So he is, like, that is kind of understood to be canon in this movie. And there is, like, isn't someone's... Hector's kind of seems to be skeptical of the power of the gods.
Mm. There's a lot of talk about, like, and there's all this talk about...
The gods want this, or we saw an eagle with a snake in its claw.
Exactly, and King Priam thinks that Apollo will protect him, and he will run out of luck sometime. Brad Pitt is doing an accent again in this movie.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this when we were talking about it before, but it sounds a bit like his interview with a vampire, kind of sophisticated, British-ish. Just it would be weird to have an American accent in...
Every other accent is in this movie. Every other accent.
Yeah. I mean, there's a mythology about it, right? Like, Americans didn't exist in the ancient world. We can have, like, the Scots or whatever.
I guess so.
Brian Cox isn't doing much.
I mean, Brian Cox, I think, is one of the worst performances I've seen in some time.
I think he's playing a different movie. He thinks it's
kind of not enjoyably hammy to me. He's very hammy, okay. But I don't have fun with it.
I understand that.
He just irritates me. I think I'm also irritated because Brian Cox is such a shitty person. I know he's got this Succession fame. You know, he's anti-trans people, anti-pronouns. Really? Every interview he talks about, like...
Oh, dear.
He makes, like, rude jokes. He was doing some roundtable interview, and he was like, oh, we're all going to be cancelled because we didn't introduce ourselves with our pronouns. Can you imagine something so ridiculous? I think he's just a piece of shit.
The British, right?
Don't blame everyone.
No, sorry. British. I know you're...
I'm British.
But these, like, this weird series of famous British people who feel the need... Like, I know there's a lot of transphobia, but Phil, they need to be so vocal about it.
Yeah, just shut the fuck up. It's so interesting. We've said it before. We said it about Terry Gilliam. Yeah, no one's going to ask you. No one's going to say, Brian Cox. So just shut your fucking mouth. It honestly doesn't matter. Fucking dickheads. Can I read this kind of pivotal Brad Pitt quote about this film? So I don't... There's lots of questions to ask about this. But here's the quote in full from Brad Pitt. I had to do Troy because I pulled out of another movie and then had to do something for the studio. So he was obviously contractually obligated. So I was put in Troy. It wasn't painful, but I realized that the way that movie was being told was not how I wanted it to be. I made my own mistakes in it. And then he says, what am I trying to say about Troy? I could not get out of the middle of the frame. It was driving me crazy. I'd become spoiled working with David Fincher. Huh. It's no slight on Wolfgang Peterson. Das Boot is one of the all-time great films. But somewhere in it, Troy became a commercial kind of thing. Every shot was like, he is the hero. There was no mystery. It's a good quote.
Really smart.
That spells out a lot of things that we talk about often with this man.
Well, I kept thinking about... Brad Pitt is someone who is agile and flexible and... chaotic in his movements. Achilles is not a chaotic fighter. He is, even like Achilles is doing all the jumping around. Every now and then he gets angry in this film and you kind of see Brad Pitt come through. Mm-hmm. But
as usual, right? Pitt just went. Yeah. Is it because he's having the most fun or?
But he's so choreographed. Every move of Achilles, like all the fights are this hand goes here and this pushes against this and this shield comes up. So there's no room for him to express himself. And he's in this armor all the time. Or he's, like, naked and lethargic. So there's kind of not...
There's not much for him to do.
There's not much for him to do. And he's not great in this film. He's fine. He's not bad. No, he's not bad, but he's not great.
No, he's not the best performer.
And he doesn't... Like, he works as Achilles. I think he's, like, a good casting decision as Achilles because Achilles is kind of spoiled and moody and Brad Pitt's great at those things. I understand why they put him in it. It is interesting, though, that given what he says about that, the plan B was involved. I don't understand that.
No, I don't understand that either. That's very weird. Oh, but they founded it. Okay. He founded it with Jennifer Aniston, and then when they split up, he became the sole owner, which was in 2005, which is the year after Troy.
It is its first film.
Yeah, that's very interesting. What's its second film?
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Tim Burns, and then The Departed.
This is a weird slate of films.
It is weird because they also divided into the 2000s, 2010s, and on Wikipedia into decades for no reason.
Yeah. It's so funny to think that he said that he doesn't make a dime from Plan B.
Oh boy, he made the new Jon Stewart film that looks real bad.
Yeah. Have you read about the twist of that film?
I don't think so.
You should preserve it. Okay. It's so stupid. It will make you extremely angry.
Should I see the film?
I will not see it personally, but like if you want to. He also produced Minari, which is meant to come out in a couple of months, which is probably the most critically acclaimed film of the year. It's about a South Korean family that resettled in America.
I saw a trailer for it. It looks amazing. It
does look amazing. Steven Yeun looks great in it.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is, and we can see it in the films, right? Like, that's not to say that after the point of Troy, Brad Pitt never does anything commercial again.
He does Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
He does Mr.
and more Two More Oceans films.
But less and less.
Yeah, this is. I think this is a pivot point.
Yes, I think it is. I think this is a guy being like, I don't have to do this anymore. I think that's what he's saying in that quote about being spoiled with David Fincher. He's like, I've worked with great artists who care and think about films other than just like, this is a marketing exercise. Yeah. Which I feel like I can slight Wolfgang Peterson. Peterson started out as a very interesting director, but this is not an interestingly directed film.
No,
there's no vision, there's no voice. It's advertising. It's like you've got hot people, you've got nice locales, like just shoot to show off those things.
I think, maybe, I wonder if the story with Plan B, and again, this is wild speculation and probably not true, is he needs to get it off the ground, he needs money, so he attaches it to Troy so it can become a thing, like... that can create, it can become an operating organization that will bring in a profit with that film. And from there, it can then, and then that allows Brad Pitt. I still don't feel like I'm on first name terms with him.
I think I am.
Maybe.
I was so glad to see him in
Me
this film.
Too. It was like coming home.
Yeah.
Because he's able to maintain the brand as Brad Pitt through being a producer and then doesn't have to do anything. Doesn't have to have studios put him in things anymore.
No. He can just do whatever the fuck he wants.
Which is kind of what seems to happen post... like, 5 years after this.
Well, what are the films after this, right? I think it's worth just looking at the run. Because it's a weird, interesting run. Which means that we're finally in, like, a run of
very watchable films.
Yeah, this is kind of the turning. As we've said, this is the turning point.
Ocean's 12, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Then Babel. Right, oh, yeah. So then he's immediately, then Ocean's 13, then Assassination of Jesse James, then Burn After
Reading. Reading Curious Case of Benjamin Button and Glorious Bastard, suddenly it feels like we're in the present, you know, and Megamind.
And we're so spaced out, these films are coming out much, much further apart. We're rushing towards kind of...
Modern Brad.
Before we know it. Are there any performances we need to shout out? You pointed out Orlando Bloom is well cast, I just fucking hate that guy.
Yeah, I think he's... Paris is a sap who you're not supposed to like, and he works in that capacity.
He fucking kills Achilles, though. It's very annoying.
But that's the point. He's supposed to be a coward who kills Achilles.
I know. It's just a pain in the eyes. I don't like that it happens. It pisses me off.
It's a frustrating... Well, you take it up with...
Homer.
Homer,
Who maybe didn't exist.
Probably.
I also... The only thing I want to say, which is also another slight on fucking David Benioff.
Mm-hmm.
So if I ever do get my Truman Show horror film up and running, I better not run into David Benioff at a party. Benioff has obviously decided, the way to tackle the Iliad is to say that this is a film about people wanting to be remembered. Because it comes up so fucking often.
Which does happen in the books.
But it's all anyone talks about. It's the last line of the movie. Everyone's always saying, like, you're doing this to be remembered. You won't be remembered. I'll be remembered.
Your name, etc., etc.
It's so thematically boring.
A little kid asks Achilles, what is it?
It's so stupid. Yeah,
that's like, the introduction.
Why are you going? Why are you running to fight this guy?
He's like, I'd be too scared to fight him. And Brad says, because that's why no one will remember your name.
Dipshit. Yeah. Thing saying you're a kid.
I'm like an 11-year-old dunking on him.
You know the guy, the big tall guy? This is the first fight. Yeah. Which actually, when you type into YouTube, Troy film, the first thing that comes up is this fight between Achilles, Brad Pitt, and this really big tall guy. Which is the scene where, this guy is throwing spears.
Yeah.
Pitt dodges them all and then just... neatly gets him in the neck.
Very cool, which is kind of funny.
It is kind of funny. The actor who plays that tall big guy is an Australian actor.
Oh.
Who is the big guy from Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, fun.
You know, one of the sons of Immortan Joe, the Emperor, the really tall guy. Which also made me realize something I probably should have realized earlier. Mad Max Fury Road is a little bit... Iliad.
Sword and Sandal.
It's definitely Sword and Sandal, but I think even more specifically Iliad. Because the plot contrivance is, quote-unquote, stealing a wife.
Yeah, and people coming after the wife.
Don't know what there is to think about that. The last thing maybe before Letterboxd, unless there's something you have pressing.
Not really.
I think the thing that makes this film so weird, which I realized halfway through...
Mm.
Is that it is a mimesis of a mimesis. It's a copy of a copy.
Yeah.
It's not a copy of the Iliad. It's a copy of the 1950 Hollywood sword and sandal epics that are copies of the Iliad.
That's true. It's returning to the original material that was the inspiration for those things, but in a way that doesn't really go back to the original.
No. And that's why I was like, that's why this feels so glossy and strange. It's not an attempt to tell the story at the heart of the Iliad. It's an attempt to tell a story like the stories that have already been told.
Yeah.
Mark Fisher, the political theorist and author, used to talk a lot about the zombification of culture. Things never die, they just start coming back. It's very easy to think of that as a modern problem, you know, endless reboots, endless sequels, but it was happening as early as 2004. The only films that were getting made were films that were like another film.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, we complained endlessly about weird films that we've watched, like, what's the film where they get sent to, like, a reform school? Robert De Niro's in it?
Yeah, the priest. Sleepers?
Sleepers. Like, we complain quite a lot of that. But
that's what's that? Yeah, it's not based on anything. It's weird.
It's deeply weird. Possibly completely made up. Like, yeah. Possibly not based on a true story. Very odd. Should we do Letterboxd?
People. Yeah, I'd say...
Go on.
3.7.
What did you say?
3.7?
3.1.
Oh, okay.
Just surveying my friends who've watched it, it's 3 stars, 1 star, 1.5 star, 1 star, 1.5 star.
That makes sense.
People don't like this.
I guess I'm thinking about its success at the box office, but that doesn't mean anything.
But I think it's worth pointing out, we like it more than those people.
Yeah, definitely.
I gave this film 2.5 stars.
I think I might even, 3.
I said, my review was, Brian Cox, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Okay, reviews. Do you want to see some 5-star reviews first?
Yeah, I'm interested in that.
This is just a 2-star review I just have to read. I cannot believe how heterosexual they made this. Cousins? Yeah. Cousins? Their ashes were buried together.
Great.
And someone else said, they made Achilles straight. Achilles. So you want a 5-star?
Yeah.
I can't read that one. That's too insane.
What?
No, it's just some... It's someone... Yeah, I can't. I can't. It's genuinely too insane. Sometimes you have to draw a line.
Sure.
I mean, sometimes you just want to read someone just getting right to the point, sure. Right? This person has no top 4 films, but they gave Escape from New York, the John Carpenter masterpiece, 2.5 stars.
Okay.
And then they said, of Troy, which they gave 5 stars. Haven't seen this movie since the late 2000s. While long, it tells an amazing story. The timeline of the movie is a journey. And then this bit, probably one of Prad Bitt's best movies. So fucking
indecipherable.
Hell. This one 5 stars. The username is Vacancies Iraq. The review just says jobs in Iraq. Search and apply on the latest jobs in Baghdad, Mosul, Erbil, and all over Iraq for free. Build online resumes for free and get viewed by the top employers in Iraq. Oh my god, so there's spam there are porn bots on Letterboxd. They've just started. You'll be followed by a young woman with a profile picture that's kind of scandalous, salacious, and the top 4 films will be like quasi porn films.
I love that detail.
And they'll be like, hit the link to come and see photos of me and my friends. But yeah, Vacancies of Rock is the single.
That rules.
I'm going to screenshot that.
Because this film was made in Malta. Sometimes these films are made in the Middle East.
Yeah, maybe the thinking is like, someone might be looking up
5-star reviews.
That's so funny. Someone said, will always be a 5-star movie in my heart because of all the sexy men folk.
Well, would Troy be in Iraq? If it was or Iran?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I did a whole fucking course. Yeah, I should definitely know. I don't know. My geography is so bad.
Yeah, mine's pretty bad as well. I may have made a fool of myself there, but it's not my job, I guess.
5-star review. Back when I'd rather have Brad Pitt do the breastfeeding.
Apparently turkey. What?
What does that mean?
I don't know. It's indecipherable.
Back when I'd rather have Brad Pitt do the breastfeeding.
One more 5-star.
Haven't seen this movie in like 15 years. Around the time this movie came out, kids at school started teasing me by calling me Brad Pitt. To this day, it baffles me how it's an insult to be compared to the most attractive man who ever existed. That's just an attempt to be like, I'm hot.
Yeah, a humble brag.
I want to read another one because I haven't done a 4-star. Oh, God. Letterboxd is just...
inscrutable.
It's... You know, it used to be the place where I'd go which was kind of free from the worst elements of Twitter. And it's getting worse, like... very unamusingly, the review that I just scrolled past is someone from that alt-right Australian Twitter group.
Oh, geez.
And that, like, yeah, making extremely racist remarks in the review of Troy. What is... Anyway.
Yeah, it's everything. Everything's being ruined.
Ebchurch. They don't have a top four film, so I'm going to read you their last four reviews.
Okay.
They gave Steven Spielberg's Lincoln 2.5 stars.
Sure.
Have you seen that film?
I watched the first half of it on a plane and was like, this is not a plane film.
Do you want me to spoil the ending?
Lincoln gets shot.
He's at the theater.
Yeah, okay.
3.5 stars to the Scarlett Johansson Ghost in the Shell remake.
Oh, that was weird, apparently, right? And also, she's appropriative.
Do you know the craziest spoiler alert for that film? You come to learn that she is a cyborg based on the memories of a real life human being who was killed.
Classic premise.
The human being who was killed is cast as a Japanese person. So, like,
they're not even
the
trying.
The whitewashing was a big spectacle, but, like, surely you just go back and you reshoot it.
Make a Scarlett Johansson.
It makes it worse.
That's very funny.
Because you literally have, anyway, The Lives of Others.
Oh, yeah, I like that film.
I knew you'd like that film.
Yeah.
Do you like that film a little bit or a lot bit? You seem
unimpressed. I remember quite liking it.
Seems like a very Dan film to me.
Yeah, I think I had thought I would like it more than I did. I do have that memory.
The last line is stuck in my head, and I haven't seen that film for maybe like 14 years. Do you remember it?
No.
Spoiler alert for The Lives of Others.
Yeah.
It's about a playwright being monitored by a member of
the
Stasi.
Secret Service, yeah.
And the playwright gets out and writes a book. And I think on the front page, there's some dedication that's like, to my secret. It's a code acknowledging that the play is dedicated to the Stasi guy. And the Stasi guy goes to a bookstore, buys the book, looks at the dedication, walks up to the counter, hands it over to the woman, and she's like, oh, would you like this gift wrapped? And he says, no, it's for me. Which is just like such a beautiful last line.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Ricky Gervais from Ghost Town?
No.
He's a dentist in that film.
Yeah.
And he falls in love with this woman who has this tragic past, and he can see ghosts. It's not a very good final film. But she comes to him at the end of the film as a dentist, and like she needs dental work. Not she comes to him as a dentist.
In his capacity as a dentist.
And she's like, it hurts when I smile. And he says, I can fix that. Like another extremely beautiful final
line.
That
is good. I hate Ricky Gervais, obviously.
Yeah, but a great final.
I'll pay that.
You know who loves The Lives of Others? Conservatives.
Oh.
They're obsessed with that film.
Because it's anti-communist.
Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah, I don't know how I stumbled across that, but I stumbled across some list of like conservatives' favorite films, and they all say like The Lives of Others.
It's so funny.
Because they're like, it's the film that teaches you the horror of communism.
Sure.
And Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
I like that film.
I knew you'd like that
film. Yeah, that's a good one.
You like that film a little bit or a lot, film?
I liked it a lot, but also on its own terms. Like, I'm not saying it's better than The Lives of Others, but a fine documentary. Compelling. The son dynamic in that is so funny.
It's so sad. This poor guy.
He's like one of the best sushi chefs in Japan, but he's one of his sons, but like not enough.
Yeah,
like,
never enough. And this is not, I'm not just referencing due to cultural ties, I'm also referencing because I think they're very similar. Hayao Miyazaki, the head of Studio Ghibli, his son is also an animator.
Right.
And famously, he said something after his son made that Tales from Earthsea movie where he was like, yeah, it was okay. Can you imagine?
Brutal.
Can you imagine? So this person's five star review, surpassing even the original text. Perhaps the greatest work of all time.
That's a joke, surely.
Besides Brad Pitt's bare upper body.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's not as gay as the original, but this doesn't mean we can't still appreciate these other nice things. I'm guessing it's a joke.
Yeah, it's got to be a joke.
Better than the original.
I thought that was serious. If it was serious, that would be good stuff.
Do you want the lowest first?
Let's have a one star, yeah.
Everyone's on the cousin thing. This person just says, yeah, man, me and my cousin have already decided to mix our ashes when we die so we can be together forever. Seeing Tenet and this in the same night broke me. You saw Tenet?
I saw Tenet.
We haven't talked about it.
No.
I haven't seen Tenet. You didn't like it.
No, I didn't dislike it.
Really?
I had a good time, yeah.
A very good time or a not so good
time? A fine time. It's very confusing. It's maybe one of the most confusing films I've ever seen.
Is it?
Not, okay. That's incorrect. I always basically understood the stakes. The details are baffling, and you just cannot hear most of what people are saying. Christopher Nolan is obsessed with putting things in front of people's faces.
It's so funny.
Crazy that this film came out during a global pandemic that stopped people seeing it, because he is obsessed with not being able to hear what people say because they have masks on their faces.
It's so funny to me. That
in Dunkirk,
For years, Bane. When Bane came out, everyone was like, I can't hear what he's saying.
They remixed the sound and people still couldn't hear what he was saying.
And then,
this is not a spoiler, but in the climax of Tenet, a conversation takes place between the protagonist and...
Who is called the protagonist.
And the antagonist, who is played by Kenneth Branagh.
Mm.
And...
Doing a good job, I hear. I like Kenneth Branagh.
But one of them is wearing a mask and one of them is on the phone. And it is a pivotal conversation and you cannot really understand what either of them are saying. One of them is wearing a mask talking from, like, behind the gate on the phone to him, and a lot of other stuff is happening.
That's just so funny.
So confusing as to, like, these decisions are just, like... I genuinely...
Why does he do it?
It's such a weird tick.
Why does he do it? Is it a fetish? Or is he just listening in, like, private cinemas with excellent sound?
In the editing booth, it's all exquisite.
It sounds perfect to him. Because for a long time, people have said, Chris, we cannot understand what's going on. And he refuses to change.
It's fascinating.
I kind of admire
it. Yeah, me too, because it's such a weird hill to die on. Just remix the sound.
I have to ask a few basic questions about things that I've heard happen in Tenet. Is it true that Elizabeth Debicki reaches through the... Because she's, you know, she's like 6'3".
Yeah, she's
She does some tall person shit where she like reaches through. She's sitting in the back of a car.
Yeah.
And she opens it from the back. Is that correct?
I think that is true, yes.
Okay. Is she good in the movie?
Yeah, she is.
But she plays a wife, right?
Yeah, she's... It's Alana, my partner. We saw it together and she said... It feels like Christopher Nolan went to like a diversity seminar spent an afternoon at a diversity seminar and was like, oh, I have to make some changes. But he just added the wife and made the protagonist African American.
Okay. It's not deep changes, absolutely very cosmetic. And is Kenneth Branagh good?
Yeah. Yes, actually, he's great. He does an insane accent.
Great.
He's more fun to watch than most people and genuinely compelling on screen.
I love Branagh. I've always loved Branagh.
Yeah.
My mum cooked dinner for him.
Whoa.
She knew someone who knew him, and he came over and she cooked. I don't know. My mum's not a good cook at the best of times, but she decided to cook something quite complicated.
Okay.
She calls herself not a bad cook, by the way. I'm not being the ungrateful son who's like using my podcast to brag on my mum's cooking. She's famously bad at cooking. She once made a gingerbread cake and she forgot to mix it properly. So when I was eating it, there's just like mouthfuls of baking soda.
Goodness.
One of the worst experiences I've had eating a meal.
Yeah.
I also, whenever I tell that story, I always think like, how much baking soda must she have put in?
Maybe a huge amount. Instead of flour or something, it would be like
And she tried to make some kind of cabbage dish and she burnt it. But Kenneth Branagh was apparently quite nice. Which is good.
I liked him. Didn't he direct something awful recently?
He's... a bad director these days. He directed the Artemis Fowl movie that went straight to
Disney
Plus. Oh,
that's right. I listened to a podcast about that.
But he used to be great. Did you ever see Dead Again? That really great ghost noir film he made?
I enjoyed his Thor.
I like Thor. I like Kenneth Branagh. Yeah. His Hamlet is an all-time great movie. Have you seen the Hamlet that he starred in directed? It's like 4 hours long. You'd love it.
I've seen him in... I think he's in Othello or...
He is in Othello.
Yeah,
with Denzel Washington.
That's great. Yeah.
He's... who'd you was he?
Bad guy. Right?
Yeah, what is that guy's name?
I really should know that.
I should know that too.
He's
just a bad guy for the sake of being a bad guy.
Yeah, he's one of the great Shakespearean villains.
Yeah, because he's just like, I'm going to fuck with these people.
Yeah.
Truly hate it here. Brad Pitt is literally the worst possible Achilles. Cast a twink and stop trying to make him cool and heroic. He's such a bitch, dude. Okay, let's get something more substantial.
One more, maybe?
Yeah, let me do one more. We've got to get ready for Xavier to come and do our Sinbad episode, which you will have already heard. Unless we die or something. Don't you think that? I mean, like...
Yeah, I know.
What if something
happened? Yeah, exactly. Like, we presume this has already happened, but the future's unknowable.
Future's unwritten. I'm going to rank by review popularity.
Okay.
So there we cut through, hopefully, the shit, and we just get the good stuff. Okay, this person's top 4 film. Yeah, interesting.
Okay.
Synecdoche, New York.
Great film.
Do you think that?
I need to go back to it.
Sure, go back to it. Werkmeister Harmonies. Bellatar film.
Oh, yeah.
Probably my favourite Bellatar.
Okay, I gotta see it.
It's not that long. It's 140 minutes.
All right.
Are you gonna watch Satan Tango?
Yeah, I forgot it's on Criterion. I will.
It's on Criterion Channel. Along with Texas Chainsaw
Massacre. Oh yeah, it's on my list. Maybe I'll watch it tonight.
Put it high on your list.
Okay.
You would have a great time.
I don't know if that's true, Joseph.
I don't think it's true. You should either watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Antichrist.
Tonight. Okay. Right. I'll be glad I watched it.
Antichrist, I think you'd like Antichrist better.
Okay.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre is just designed to make you distressed. Not you specifically.
Yeah, I've seen some of it before.
It's just probably the best piece of art ever made. But Antichrist is more you, right? Because it's more literate. Yeah. It's easier to understand what it's quote-unquote about.
Yeah. Sure. I will not take that as an insult, but sure.
I know. We've discussed it. You like films that are mannered.
Yeah, it's true. I won't deny it.
Talk in a literate language. That's what you want.
Yeah.
Which is why, have you seen Leviathan?
Russian film? That film.
And you.
Yeah, of course.
Because it's mannered.
Book of Job. Good stuff.
2046? Wong Kar Wai film?
No.
You've seen In the Mood for Love, though, haven't
yes.
you? Yes. So you like Wong Kar Wai?
Yes.
Okay. Compromise. That's what this film should have been called. I cannot even begin to understand why anyone in their right mind would think it is a feasible idea to condense one of the cornerstones of literature and perhaps one of the greatest epics ever documented to 2.5 hours. I don't think that's
the problem. That's not the problem. It's a... Because also, the Iliad is not... I mean, it's long-ish. But, like, there are longer books.
Yeah, and better books.
And also, a lot, like, as you say, not that much happens in the Iliad.
No, so what
a list of names.
Yeah, would you put in the catalogue of shit?
That's not the problem, mate.
That would be funny. Bloom, Orlando Bloom, yeah. And Kruger, Diane Kruger, who is mm-hmm. Helen, as Paris and Helen, are absolutely abysmal.
Okay.
Their performances are devoid of almost anything remotely resembling one of the most iconic loves ever. It's also not that iconic.
No, it's iconic only because it's in the story. Like, as a love story, Paris is not great. Like, it's not a grand... That's not the point.
No.
It's and a MacGuffin.
Listen to this misogyny. Helen is not even close to the face that launched a thousand ships. What would they... How would you...
Who are they casting?
Yeah, who are you casting to be like, oh, this is the most beautiful person in the world. Ever.
Yeah.
No gods, no magic, no tragic love, no mystery, just men slugging it out, looking gruff and serious. Source material as incredible as this deserves a whole lot more love and respect than Troy has given to it.
Yeah.
106 likes, that review.
People are just being pretentious.
I guess
so. Showing they've read the Iliad.
I guess so.
Good stuff.
134 minutes. If you were watching Troy right now, you'd have like half of Troy to go.
Us?
Yeah.
Oh, we're boy.
134.
Really? Was it
not 134. 94 minutes.
Oh, good. Okay.
Over 2 hours.
Yeah. It's no.
Is this film longer than Nixon?
No. No, it's not. Although there is a director's cut. Let me just very quickly...
It's gotten dark in here.
Actually, Daniel. Maybe I'll leave this for the podcast with Xavier, so you'll have already heard about the Troy director's cut. Is that insane?
It's a little insane.
Okay. it's director's cut. Various shots were recut. I'll just read this bit. And then we'll finish. Troy director's cut was screened at the 57th Berlin International Film Festival on February 17, 2007. At least 1,000 new cuts, or almost 30 extra minutes of footage, with a new running time of 196 minutes. The DVD was released in 2007 in the US. The score of the film was changed dramatically, with many of the female vocals being cut. In addition to the music is the use of Danny Elfman's theme for Planet of the Apes during the pivotal fight between Hector and Achilles in front of the gates of Troy. Josh Groban's song was removed. Various shots were recut and extended. For instance, the love scene between Helen and Paris was reframed to include more nudity of Diane Kruger. The love scene between Achilles and Briseis is also extended.
Why the extended, Planet more of gore. The Apes?
Bookend scenes were added. Dogfighting its dead master.
Why the Planet of the Apes?
Totally baffling.
Have you seen that Tim Burton Planet of the Apes?
No.
Do you know what the score sounds like?
No.
It's drums. It's rhythmic.
That's
drumming.
That's right. I did know that. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much for listening. We will have seen you.
I've seen you already, and then we will see you again.
For Ocean's 12.
Ocean's 12.
Have you seen that movie?
I think I have.
I don't know if I have.
It blurs with Ocean's 11. But we'll find out.
You'll find out next time.
So, yeah. Love you all.
On
the Brad Pitt cast.
See you then.
Bye, everybody.